ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Will hearts break again? That's the question that will be answered in this edition of The Bookshelf. Hello, I'm Cassie McCullough, and yes, it's a big promise, but that's what you get when one of the world's great contemporary authors returns to their best-loved novel to write a sequel. Awaiting us is Long Island, Colm Tobin's follow-up to his 2009 international best-selling tragic romance, Brooklyn. But exactly whose heart will break? Jonathan Green is presenter of Blueprint for Living, and he's here. He may well know it could be his own heart. Jonathan, hello.
It may well be. I, in reading this book, I have been cast into the arms of that great Australian moral philosopher, Natalie Imbruglia. And as she points out, heartbreak, illusion never changed into something real. I'm wide awake and I can see the perfect sky is torn.
I didn't know you're a Natalie Imbruglia fan.
Oh, I am, but it works for this book. It rarely, actually, does reading a novel give you an earworm. But I got torn all through reading Long Island, I'm afraid, but never mind.
I see what you did there. My goodness. Well, this is just one of the surprises, I think, that lies ahead. Benjamin Law will also be here to review Ghost Cities by Australia's Xiang Lu, which is inspired, Jonathan, by the uninhabited megacities of China.
And what a wonderful book it is. Madeline Gray is also in, author of Green Dot, and she's joining us to talk about Real Americans by Malaysian Chinese American Rachel Kong.
But first, let's return to old New York. The Irish writer Colm Tobin is, I guess it's fair to say, one of the great writers of the age. And frankly, Jonathan, if he wanted to write about an old shoe that he'd found while he was walking down the street, I would be there.
Before we get to any of the detail of Long Island, it is such a joy to read his words, to read the rhythm of his words, to hear his, what must be, I think, his voice in that writing. There is such a distinct quality about the way he composes a sentence and just the lilting rhythm of the way he writes.
Yes, it's so Irish but so universal as well. And through a small detail, he's able to send an arrow straight into your chest.
Yes, it's not cloying, but it really hurts.
Yes, he's so good at it. And I love...
And suspense!
Kill me. The Magician that he wrote about Thomas Mann, his last novel, I loved that. Fantastic. I loved his book of essays out recently. Can't even remember the name of it, but
I've not read that, but I want to seek that out. Oh. I'd love to read him in a non-fiction phase. That would be very interesting indeed.
So here we are, not setting him up for a fall at all.
No. But this book's rubbish, however. No, it's not.
No, it's not rubbish.
No, it's not. Calm down, everybody. Yeah.
But it is a sequel to Brooklyn. And if you haven't read that, we are about to explain the plot of that because it's necessary. And also, you've had more than 15 years to read it. So what have you been doing? Now, it won the Costa Novel Award in the year it was published, 2009. It's about Eilish Lacey, who emigrates from Ireland in the just after the war, to New York. And she lives in a boarding house, studies bookkeeping, and lives this quite sort of lonely life until she meets Tony.
Tony the plumber.
The Italian-American plumber at an Irish dance. And they're quite attracted immediately.
Tragedy, though, strikes, and Eilish gets word her sister Rose dies in her sleep, and she has to, of course, return home. They do something before she goes, though, Tiny and Eilish. They get married. It's all a bit hush-hush.
Yeah, and it's sort of impulsive and you don't know why she's done it. Is it
because...
Well, they're
crazy madly in love. And I wonder, is it trying to stake some sort of claim of permanence in this place to sort of know that you're going to go back?
And
is that what that's about?
She's also been so starved of affection and company that Tony and his lovely big family something...
His Italian exuberance.
Yes, something she craves. So perhaps that was it. So they have this secret marriage in a registry office. But she gets home to Enniscorthy.
Little village.
Which is also where Colm Tobin's from. And Eilish is comforted by her old friend Nancy and Nancy's fiancé, Gerard. Mm. And through them, she meets Jim Farrell, who's the sole son of a publican, quite a catch, a little bit, doesn't talk much, but Eilish's mother in particular thinks he's...
He has a mysteriously compelling quality, Jim Farrell. I can't quite see it myself, but it's there.
Look, I was a bit devastated at the end of Brooklyn when, and this is the big spoiler, Eilish goes back to America and back to Tony. And it's not really through choice.
Jim Farrell, Devo.
He's completely torn apart. But what's happened is some town gossip has told Eilish that she was seen at the registry with Tony by some other Irish person, and so she's been found out. She's married, so she can't marry Jim. So she tells her mother the truth, and her mother's just shocked and appalled, and she just leaves Jim a letter.
But then she goes back to New York, and there's the man she loves.
Well, I mean, that's not the happy ending that I wanted.
Well, yes, which is an ending, though, that sweeps us into the opening pages of Long Island.
Yeah, so that was all Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it was made into a film. It's a bestseller. People love it. They've been, you know, it's...
It's a beautiful romance.
It is.
And I have... Can I put this out there?
Mm-hmm.
Long Island begins with Tony and Eilish. They've got kids, but Tony turns out to be a dirty rat. It's 20 years later. And Tony, the plumber, has been doing more than plumbing on one of his jobs, and the person with whom he plumbed is now pregnant.
Yes, he has. He's been a very naughty boy. That Irishman has been here again, Francesca said, sitting down at the kitchen table. He's come to every house, but it's you he's looking for. I told him you'd be home soon. What does he want? Eilish asked. I did everything to make him tell me, but he wouldn't. He asked for you by name. He knows my name. So this is how the book begins.
Yes.
That's Francesca, the mother-in-law.
The husband of the woman where Tony was doing the plumbing.
He's come around.
He's unimpressed. This is what sort of stuck with me a little bit. It is... If I had loved Brooklyn, if I had been carried away with the, at the end of the day, with the romance between Eilish and Tony, I'd feel terribly let down about this opening for Long Island where Tony turns out to be, a disappointing man.
Yeah, because you know that Eilish has given up everything.
So much.
Not just Jim Farrell, but the comfort of home, her mother, her brother, her town, this place where everyone knows everything about you and you are just a thing, a presence. Instead, she works as a bookkeeper in a mechanics shop. She's sort of slaved over keeping the family together. She looks after this beautiful son and daughter that she and Tony have. But she's also part of this quite suffocating family atmosphere.
So this is the Fiorelli family. This is Tony's family, and they're Long Island. The title of the book. They have moved into this little family cul-de-sac in Long Island. They are surrounded by Fiorellis.
Yeah, they've built four houses just so they can all be together all the time.
It is claustrophobic. Utterly. And there's a sort of an irony here, isn't it? The woman who has fled the little village in Ireland is now trapped in this enclave of Fiorellis in Long Island.
Yeah, strong-armed in those loving arms of this family. And in particular, the mother-in-law who rules in de facto, really, because the father still holds the power.
She's an Italian mother. She has a certain sway over her sons. And one of the elements in which she has sway is that the grandmother, Francesca, is determined that Tony, the errant husband, should adopt the child, which is his, through the other woman. This does not please Irish in the least. Mm.
So this Irishman, ironically, who is the husband of the impregnated woman...
bringing you the baby.
He says, I'm going to leave it on your doorstep and I'm walking away. That child will not be raised in my house. And Eilish doesn't want it.
No.
Why on earth would she want it? So she
but
just says to Tony,
stuck with it.
You know, send it to an orphanage. But Mama doesn't like the idea of one of her son's children being cast off.
Yes. And Eilish, as her son's wife, has a duty, a responsibility to raise that child, the child of Francesca's son.
And so things are happening behind the scenes. Conversations are being had that Eilish isn't a part of. And the family has begun to make decisions about what's going to happen to this baby and therefore what's going to happen to Eilish.
What would I do in that situation?
Yeah, what would you do?
I'd pack my bags. What Eilish decides she will do.
Indeed. She tells the children what's happened and then she says to Tony, I'm going back to Ireland. And he says, for a holiday? And she doesn't really answer him.
Yes.
But off she goes and the children are to follow.
She's not doing it with a sense of permanence. I mean, she's putting the onus here on Tony to do the right thing, which is to say have nothing to do with the other child. And the question of what Tony will do is open. We don't know at the point that Eilish leaves whether what is going to happen, but we know that she will be watching and waiting, and should things not be done as she would have them done, she may not return.
Now, this all happens in, you know, the first pages.
It's very quick.
It's so great. It's such a great re-entry.
This would trouble me as a fan of Brooklyn, I think. Everything that I might have loved about their relationship is just blown up in the course of half a chapter. It's quite abrupt and confronting.
Mm. Yes, I agree. And I've always had a reticence about Tony and the choice she made.
Too good to be true.
Well, he wasn't that great. I mean, he's lovely. But the relationship she had with Jim Farrell was so deep and so subterranean, the way they communicated with very sparse conversation. Their understanding of each other was beyond words. So they shared a culture.
That's it, I think. He is a man of that other world, and that other world is a slower place and a deeper place and a more thoughtful place. But New York is not that place. New York is a place of Tony's brashness. It's a good movers on the dance floor. That's New York.
Well, there's some good movers on the dance floors of Enniscorthy as well, which
that,
is...
That also happens, yes.
Yeah, where we go in the next part of this. And we don't meet Eilish again for a while. She hasn't arrived. But who we do meet is Nancy, who is now widowed. Lovely Jared, whom she truly loved.
Yes.
Has died, and she's raising her son and daughter above a
fish and chip shop.
Yeah.
It's all full of horrible fatty smoke. The painting of that scene, the chipper, and the life, the sort of grease-stained, cod-smelling life that Nancy has in her grief, in her tragedy.
And her poverty as well. So she's had to create this business to keep the kids going. And all the neighbours on the street hate it because she stays open after the pubs close. So there's all these drunkards and vomiting and yelling and fighting, and also this constant chip fat smoke filling the street, and she can't do anything about it because she can't afford to fix the, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she's still a little bit attractive, but she's worn down by life and also her sadness.
She's put on a few pounds, I think the point is made. But
yes, that is made, that point.
It is. Let's not dwell on it, just to observe that the point is made.
Yeah.
But guess who's over the road?
Yeah. Trusty Jim Farrell. Single.
Still single.
20 years on.
Rolling in money. Has the pub.
And sadness.
It was his parents' pub. He lives over it as his parents have sort of moved away from the business and left it to him. So he's got a nice place to live above the pub. But, yes, still Jim as well as Nancy touched with that lingering sense of grief and regret over Eilish.
But he's managed to get over that enough to have started a secret affair with Nancy.
Nancy or an item.
Yes. And just as they were thinking of going public with a engagement, Nancy's daughter, Miriam, announces that she's going to get married. And so Nancy, out of propriety and mother's love, says, oh, we can't possibly, you know, overshadow her big day. We'll wait.
Big mistake, Nancy. Yeah. Big mistake.
Big mistake. Because in walks Eilish. So we're not going to say any more about that, Jonathan, because people do need to read and find out how this tangled web
unravels. We can sort of raise some questions, can't we, I guess?
Where do we start? I mean, it's about migration, about loss, not belonging in one place or another once you've made that big cross across the ocean.
About smallness of community, but and how that can be both beautiful and stifling. It's about nature. It's about the natural world around this place, the fields, the sea, the cliffs, the sand.
It's also about personal failing and the moment, and in a way actually it reminded me of Ian McEwan's On Chesil Beach, which is a bit of a giveaway if people have read that, because sometimes you just have to grab life and take that opportunity and stake your claim. Otherwise, you may have a ghost life, really. Is that going too far?
Yeah, well, I think you need to. Yeah, well, decisions are important, and they can be, you know, choices can be presented to you, and sometimes you need to jump in.
Well, Eilish has certainly been decisive in leaving New York. You can certainly give her that. But
she has, yes.
Yeah, it's a beautiful novel. At the end, I did actually say out loud, oh, my God, you're not going to do this to me.
Yeah, but he did do that to you.
And I did the naughty thing and I went straight to the last page and, oh, God!
See, if this were a piece of streaming television, I would say, oh, okay, setting up the third season, I would say to myself. And I guess that possibility exists for Colin Toybean, that maybe there is part three. Yeah. Who knows?
Quite possibly. But as always, that writing, that emotional manipulation that he's so good at is all present in this book.
Oh, it is indeed. You hang on every word. You want desperately for things to turn one way or the other. You are his captive in the telling of this story.
And if you like Gaelic gloom, well,
oh, it's there in abundance.
It's buckets of it. That is Long Island, the follow-up to Colm Tobin's Brooklyn. Look, I did actually rummage around in the archives and I found him talking about Brooklyn to RN's The Book Show way back in 2009 about migration. He said he didn't necessarily intend Brooklyn to be a vehicle to talk about it, but it's one of the major Irish experiences. And here he is talking about that.
The story came to me very powerfully. Once I saw it, I really had it. And I was quite, you know, sharply engaged with it. And I realised it could be done. I suppose I did see that it is a national story, not only of Ireland and the United States, but of Canada, Australia. And it is also the story of Mexico, you know, that the recent migrations into the United States, and that therefore it has a sort of power about it, the power of the last 50 years or the power of the last 100 years once those sort of migrations to America began. But what happened to me was just simply that I saw the story, it came into my mind and it stayed there. And I became intrigued by it, not for its larger implications, but for its tiny details.
Wow, what a voice.
It's so beautiful, isn't it? I've had another interview actually with him saying that after Brooklyn came out, someone in the place where he was born and grew up said, oh, we don't know that you should have told that story. And it turned out that it was actually based on a story he must have overheard as a child. And so he'd revealed this quite deeply personal story of one of the villages.
Well, that's the way of authors and fiction. You just can't trust them. Never say a word in their presence.
Well, he said the story was inside him like a seed.
It's just like a seed. Waiting to be written.
There you go. Well, Jonathan, let's meet today's guests. With us, Madeline Gray, author of the wildly successful Green Dot, and Benjamin Law. Well, there's so many things he's done, it's hard to know where to start, but you are also a novelist and a screenwriter. Hi, both.
Hi.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Madeline, what are you doing at the moment? You're working as a critic. You are everywhere, Saturday Paper, Good Weekend, Monthly, another novel?
I'm definitely in the early germinal stages of writing a new novel. But, yeah, my main thing at the moment, I actually have my PhD viva tomorrow.
Okay.
So that's a bit stressful.
That occupies the attention.
A little bit, yeah. And then the more fun thing I'm doing is turning Green Dot into a television show. So I'm writing the screenplay.
Oh, so good.
I'm doing the screenwriting for that, which is a lot of fun.
Have we got cast?
We don't have a cast yet, but I'm working with Drama Republic, who are UK-based. And they just did the one-day adaptation, the David Nichols one on Netflix.
Which has gone absolutely
Which is going
wild.
Gangbusters, so that's
how
a good
exciting.
Time.
Yeah. Surely you have to stunt cast the two novels' biggest fans, right? You have to write roles for them if they don't exist. The two
Who could that be?
Biggest fans being?
Oh, Benjamin's being very sweet. I've recently had two big shout-outs on Instagram from the Biocons of the world, Nigella Lawson and Gillian Anderson.
You might have heard
what?
Of them.
Yeah.
So good.
So I do need to write some roles for them.
Oh, you
definitely
have to do that.
Squeeze them in.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, not jealous at all. What about you, Benjamin? Last year when the announcement was made that you were leaving RN's Stop Everything after
Which
6 years
still
co-hosting.
Over.
Well, look, we were told that you were stepping back so that you could, quote, focus on some big, exciting and non-disclosable projects in 2024. So was that just so you could kick back and bludge a bit?
Now that you say it like that, it sounds very adjacent to the politician's announcement that they're going to spend time with their family because they've
reasons.
Actually resigned in disgrace. But I haven't. I am working on some screen projects are really, really exciting. And
It's okay if you're not.
Yeah.
Like if you're just playing PlayStation and, you know, kicking back.
And
that's fine.
I'm just having baths, staring into the middle distance, going through all of my mistakes psychologically.
Wow.
I mean, I'm doing a bit of that as well. But I'm also working. Yeah, a few projects that hopefully I'll get to talk about in due time.
All right. Well,
that
see you in 2025.
You can't talk about them now.
No.
Oh, well, more intrigue from the incredible life of Benjamin Law. Okay, now let's turn to these books that you've read for us. And I suspect, Jonathan, that they have more in common with each other than we might have anticipated.
Well, that would be a wonderful coincidence of timing and planning, if only we could take credit for that.
As Spike Milligan would say, a big coinky dink. Now, Two Ghost Cities by Xiang Lu. When I opened this up, Jonathan, I noticed that the epigraph is by Gabriel Garcia Marquez's wife, Mercedes Marquez. And she says,
isn't that wonderful?
And what if, after all this, it's a bad novel? And this is what she said to him after he'd just finished 100 Years of Solitude. The family had been starving, living on scraps for years. And she said, it better be good.
Every artist needs to hear that after they've finished a major task.
And it's interesting that Xiang Lu would do that. I mean, that fits with, there is a sense of playfulness about his work, playfulness but very serious intent simultaneously, which is rather delightful. So it's rather engaging that he would pick those words. This book, this is his second novel, The Whitewash, 2022, was highly, highly praised. That was, you know, took all before it and was also, as Ghost Cities is, a sort of polyphonic and lightly experimental book. Ghost Cities has kind of wind-up Bird Chronicle vibes. Mm. Don't you think, Benjamin, I felt very Murakami-ish reading this, both in terms of sort of structure and tone. There's a sense of that. We have two worlds in collision and collusion here. This is a tale of dual narratives. It's complex, don't you think, Ben?
Oh, That's one word for it. There are many other words for it as well, but they're all positive. You bring up his first novel, The Whitewash, and I remember when that first came out, I read it, and I was struggling for comparisons, and the thing that I landed on was that this story, this novel, which was ostensibly about a Hollywood production that goes wrong, which originally was supposed to star an Asian American kind of like hunk, but then is whitewashed and they cast a white guy in that role. It mostly reminded me like of one of those Vanity Fair oral histories of like The Sopranos or one of those big budget films.
Wow.
And it goes completely bonkers. And so when I was reading that, I was like, this is a voice and this is a new Australian literary talent that is making a mark already with his debut. And then Ghost Cities, like you say, is complex. And again, I think Murakami is a really good reference point, but I was also thinking of a lot of cinematic reference points like Severance, in terms of that sense of dread and unknowingness of where this novel is going to take you.
Yes.
I was thinking The Truman Show, because this novel really plays with artifice and
very, very direct reference in that, I think, to Truman.
Absolutely.
Show.
And then I was like, what would a book be like if it was co-written by David Lynch and Zhang Yimou? You know, like it is kind of like a staggeringly baffling book in some ways, but it totally has its own internal logic. We should probably talk about, I mean, as we're saying this, like what is it about?
let's do that. It's basically a book of two threads, well, maybe two and a half. And in the first thread, we have a young Sydney man, young Lou. He has a job as a translator at the Chinese consulate, and he's not very good at it, mainly because he can't speak Mandarin. He uses Google Translate to do his translation, and he becomes a bit of a social media sensation. His hashtag is Bad Chinese. And that's going off when he meets the film director, Baby Bao, who's a very smooth operator. Baby Bao likes the viral potential of Bad Chinese, which takes us kind of to our second thread, which is sort of mythic tales from the reign of an ancient and cruelly imperious emperor. Okay, put those two together. Well, the way that those come together initially, I guess, is in this this thing, Death of a Pagoda, which is an unfinished text. And it was written in the emperor's time. There were three emperors called to write the emperor's origin story. He didn't like it, and he reacted as one would by banishing all those writers to the six levels of hell and destroying all the libraries.
It's a tale as old as time.
As you do. Yeah. But Death of a Pagoda is also Baby Bao's film project. So Zhang Lu is recruited with his love interest Wan, who's a Baby Bao employee, and off they go to an abandoned Chinese megacity turned film set called Portmanteau.
I mean, like, I really love Zhang Lu's play with words. I mean, even the fact that his protagonist is called Zhang Lu, like, he's having fun already right from the first page.
But Portmanteau, I think, well, it's probably Portmanteau, but even so, the reference is there. And reality and fiction are muddled in this place. This is the Truman Show kind of thing. Actors and sets create reality in this. There's a department of verisimilitude in Portmanteau to sort of keep everything on the rails. There's another thread in which the emperor's concubine is on a journey to recreate all those destroyed books and imperial knowledge with them. I mean, it sounds slightly complex. It sounds adventurous. Isn't there, Benjamin, a sort of a playful lightness about it? I mean, that lightness that is always suggestive of something in the shadows, something a bit deeper.
Yeah, it's very wry. And it is really funny. Like, there are so many moments in this book where I laughed out loud. But I think where it hit me personally is in this book of doubles and in this book of counterfeits, what Zhang Lu's really shining spotlight on is the worst counterfeit of all, which is being the bad Chinese, the inauthentic person who can't speak their mother tongue. Did this feel like a personal attack on me? Yes, it did. And so he takes it to the most extreme form, which is the protagonist who is hired to be a translator for the consulate, who does all his work through Google Translate and then becomes a meme, you know, becomes this kind of social media sensation in China and then kind of becomes a star because of his notoriety, but it's through shame. And I'm like, yes, again, I feel personally attacked. Like,
so to be clear, do you not speak Mandarin or Cantonese?
So my parents speak Cantonese to me and I understand it. And when I try to speak Cantonese back to them or to anyone else, it comes out garbled and like garbage. It's terrible. And I have to admit, even though I'm Chinese, I've been to Hong Kong many times and I feel comfortable there. But my biggest culture shock I've ever felt wasn't, you know, in India or Myanmar or in parts of Europe that are completely foreign to me. It was in China itself. And I feel like that sense of here's a protagonist who ostensibly has a connection to China, but also it's a completely foreign and baffling land. And also it's not the land that you expect either. It's communist, but it's hyper-capitalistic. And that's kind of like this other vein in the book. It's kind of what happens when you have these expectations of a person or of a place. And it's actually this simulacrum of something else. You know, the ghost city of the title references the real mega cities that have been built in China and no one lives in them. But then this protagonist goes there and he finds out, oh, there are people living there, but they're all actors acting out as extras for this deranged director's vision. And that's why I think the Emperor storyline is also this second plot, because it's very much like this story of power control that hasn't been earned, but people have to yield anyway.
What are the points of intermeshing, do you think? How do those things come together, those threads?
I mean, sometimes it's not obvious and it's a bit of a puzzle as to how they work together, and sometimes there are echoes, and then sometimes I think he's just having really good fun, you know.
Like, I think he has fun with your expectation, doesn't he? I mean, if you're writing a book with this structure, reader expectation is that we're going to see something out of each that, you know, it gives us something in combination. Sometimes that's suggested, sometimes it's not. But always in the back of your mind is that expectation that perhaps it ought to be.
I mean, when you hear a myth about China, you expect saga and operatic like legend. And he uses that cadence in those chapters to tell at one point the story of a pig that has ascended the throne briefly, and every time the pig defecates, it's construed as, you know, telling the future or having a royal decree. And like that's kind of brilliant, because it's the opposite of profound. It's ridiculous, but it also reflects the nature of power as well. So it's exactly what you were talking about, Jonathan, where the wry humor is there, but actually Xiang's actually digging at something very deep about power, about modern China, about, you know, authority, especially when it's unearned.
But doing it obliquely and doing it with whimsy, there's nothing upfront and blatant and preachy about this. This is covering all those ideas with a sort of a very deft and slightly surreal touch.
Yeah. And also what he's doing with language is really interesting. So I can't speak any Chinese languages very well, and I can't read any written Chinese scripts. But at some point,
Which needs to be said, pops in and out of the text all over the place.
Exactly. And isn't that like an interesting effect on the reader as well? Because like,
what does that say?
Yeah, it's like, I have no idea what they're saying, and it puts you incredibly in the seat of the protagonist who is supposed to know what this says and just doesn't and needs to just keep carrying on with the story. Mm. And that's what we need to do as readers as well. So it's a really beautiful play on language, really beautiful play on storytelling.
It leaps out to the eye because there are slabs of kanji. But this is one great moment that is in just the second chapter, and it's in the World Square Medical Centre, George Street, Sydney, Australia, and he's gone in because he's got a dodgy stomach, and the doctor comes and gets him and takes him into the office, and then there's these characters and a question mark, he says to his clipboard. Oh, I say, because he's made an assumption about the language I speak, my culture or who I am or must be entirely from my face. I don't speak Chinese. Ah, you're Japanese. Korean. I'm Australian. No, I mean your race. So, yeah, straight deep into the thick of it there.
Yeah.
That issue of representation is, of course, been a huge part of Xiang Lu's work, Benjamin. I mean, it's here. It was in the first book as well. This is an important element of his work as a new Australian writer.
Yeah, and it's also a spin-off of his work as well. So when he was writing The Whitewash, he was also constructing something called the Beige Index.
Yes.
And what he did was he went through the top-ranking IMD films of all time, and he basically, with a friend, charted in data and in visualized graphics how white these films had been throughout time, and it was overwhelmingly so. As much as he's having play as much as he's writing fictional story. There's this really solid thesis about his work. You know, The Whitewash was about race and representation in Hollywood, and he kind of backed that up with like a thesis that was driving that all along. And I think in Ghost Cities, he's doing something really interesting too about questioning what is real, what is fake, what do we take, why do we value authenticity so much, and what are the problems with that sometimes?
Yeah, and as you say, I mean, that subtext around representation, that can be often presented in fiction in a pretty sort of doctrinaire and sort of thumping kind of way. He just is and does this, and here is this new Australian voice who is this new Chinese Australian voice, and the perspective is incredibly distinct and clear.
Is it clear because from my, you know, glancing through this book and also reading about him, it feels like his vibe is kind of nutty, maybe like a, you know, someone who you'd find doing a cryptic crossword in about 30 seconds, like brain happening all the time in lots of different places, everything everywhere, I suppose.
Crazily active intelligence, I think, and you can sense that through this.
So it holds together as a narrative. How does it culminate?
Is it meant to hold together, Benjamin?
The centre cannot hold.
When you said everything everywhere, I immediately thought of the freneticness of that Oscar-winning film Everything Everywhere All at Once, and how it slips into different universes, and it's up to you to really take a step back and really make sense of that entire movie. And I think not in that way, but there are similarities, there are echoes in the way that he's going to take you to Imperial China, to Brisbane, all in one hit, and then to these ghost cities of China. And what I think you're left with is this feeling of being discombobulated, but also it does have this interior logic as well, which is things are not as they seem, question everything, and also there's also that sense of like a little bit Alice in Wonderland as well. Like the things that he's encountering are so strange, the Xiang Lu character, but you as a reader are also being thrust into worlds that you are not quite sure how to make sense of them. But I do think, like, as much as this novel is very unconventional and quite deeply experimental, I have to say, you are left with this uncanny sense that you have been on a ride that you get.
But I'm still processing. It's a journey novel, I think. It is about the process. It is about, it's not about reaching a particular point and a particular, you know, bundling of things in a bow. It is about the path that has taken you there and the things that have taken your mind for a wander along that path.
Well, it sounds like Ignore Him at Your Peril, Xiang Lu, Ghost Cities. And I think if there's ever a reprint of this novel, it might have something Benjamin Law, Alice in Wonderland on the cover.
So, Real Americans, our next book by Rachel Kong. Cassie, Madeline, you have read this.
I think it would be bad if we hadn't, yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing would fall apart at that point.
We should have said something earlier.
You can wing it, you're professionals.
Okay, just watch this, Jonathan. Look
at this. Who is Rachel Kong?
Well, look, firstly, I think both Madeline and I have been listening to your conversation about Ghost Cities and seeing so many parallels, surprising ones. Rachel Kong lives in California. She's a Malaysian Chinese American, and this is her second novel. The debut was called Goodbye Vitamin, and it won the 2017 California Book Award for First Fiction. This, I think, is a very different book. That was about a 30-year-old woman who goes home for Christmas after being dumped by her fiancé, only to discover that her father's been diagnosed with dementia. Oh, and in her words, it's a book about remembering, forgetting, and trying to be okay. So, you know, that world, I think, is a little bit more contained than this one, Madeline. Broad terms. Yeah. How do you describe it?
Well, yeah, it's a difficult beast to do that with. It's very much a sprawling saga. It's a multi-generational tale of three characters essentially who live in very different times. So we start in New York in 1999 with Lily, who is an unpaid intern, who is Chinese American, second second generation. Essentially, she's kind of figuring out what she wants to do with her life. It's a classic kind of story of a young woman who feels like she isn't going anywhere in her career.
And she's not.
And she's not.
She's an unpaid intern, which is this horrendous thing that the Americans have that
yeah,
we don't
absolutely
want to have take hold here.
No, we do not. Then there's this kind of meet cute with this really rich guy called Matthew, who kind of invites her into this love story, which kind of beggars belief, but you want to go along with it because it's written really romantically and it's really fun. Like, it's almost like an Emily Henry kind of vibe.
You can't believe it. You're he's just perfect.
Yeah.
Everything he does and he thinks she's wonderful. It's so convincing.
It's
as
really
a love
fun
story. It's just, what's going to go wrong? It's in your mind all the time and nothing does, and it's just like a bath,
exactly,
a warm bath. It's quite.
But then, of course, you know, the story's only a third of the way through, so something has to go wrong.
Yeah. Like, he's stunning for a start, as is she, but he's blue-eyed, fair-haired, tall, elegantly dressed. She's Chinese, but Benjamin doesn't speak Chinese.
Any Chinese languages, yeah.
And so she's often being approached by other Chinese people and making the assumption she does, which is kind of
interesting.
I have
no idea what that feels like.
Yeah. At the same time, it's coming from the opposite end where white people are, of course, fetishizing her and all the white businessmen want to have her on their arm because she's, you know, eye candy and kind of exotic. So there's those two things happening at the same time.
And her boss, Jerry, who turns out is Matthew's uncle, introduces them and he says, she's Korean. And she says, no, I'm Chinese. And then another time he says, she's Japanese.
Yeah, they're all interchangeable
quite,
to him.
You know,
yeah.
Get a handle on, you know, her otherness.
Yeah, and it's kind of delightful because you're expecting Matthew, this romantic figure, to be problematic because he is a white guy who's rich.
He's
in the year 2000.
He's stupendously rich. He's so wealthy.
And yet he somehow doesn't really make any racist remarks or sexist remarks or remarks of any other kind that would indicate complicity in the kiriarchy, which is amazing.
And he's, like, vulnerable.
Yeah.
He is very generous. They go out for dinner one night and this is when she twigs that he's a little bit rich because they're having this fantastic meal and then she says, I love Paris. And then a little bit later on, he says, well, let's go. Why don't we just go? Suddenly
reminded me of
Paris.
An episode of The Real Housewives of Sydney when Lisa Oldfield's like, I went to Paris for lunch. I was getting that energy.
But it turns out that he's from this family that he doesn't want much to do with. And we learn a little bit more about them.
The classic reluctant billionaire.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he's the guy who's got it all but doesn't want it. And she's dirt poor. In fact, she's so poor, she's had to do the humiliating thing of ringing her father instead of her mother to say, look, I need money just to survive. And she's living in this flat above some shops somewhere in New York City so that she can keep turning up to this unpaid job where she's basically cataloguing stock photos for a travel magazine. So, look, this sort of travels along and eventually she has to meet Matthew's family and so a little bit more information becomes clear. And we might just leave that part of the story there because it's very difficult to talk about without giving away some of the beautiful and carefully crafted suspense in this book. But I will point people to the first sentence or the first couple of sentences, which they sort of faded from my mind at first and then I kept coming back to it and going, hang on, what the hell is going on here? So it begins like this, 1999. My alarm rang at 7 and I pressed snooze as usual. The second time I awoke, it was still 7. This happened occasionally, these blips in my existence. I got blank stares whenever I tried explaining them, so I didn't anymore. The feeling I had was that time wouldn't move. A second would refuse to pass, as it usually did, and I would find myself trapped in a moment, unable to progress beyond a minute or two. So strange.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And Cassie, I don't know, are you going to let us talk about the other sections of the book at all?
I think we have to.
Okay.
I think we have to because this is epic.
It is really, really epic. And that moment that Cassie just read out really does, it's the strand throughout the whole novel. So essentially, we then in the next section of the novel kind of go 20 years in the future.
To the present.
To the present. And we meet the son, are we allowed to say that?
Yeah.
Okay. Not because gender is, you know, binary, because I didn't know if we could reveal. essentially, yeah, we're treated to this new character, Nick, who is Lillian Matthews' son, who no longer speaks to his father because he doesn't know who he is. And it's a kind of DNA mystery. And clearly something went wrong in the first section that we haven't been let into. So then it's about a young boy trying to come to terms with his identity without knowing his dad, and particularly as well his racial identity, because he doesn't look as Chinese as his mum does.
Guess what he looks like?
He looks like a white guy.
Blue-eyed, tall, and he's an absolute dead ringer for Matthew.
Yeah.
And Matthew, funnily enough, is a dead ringer for his father, Otto. Mm. So we start to think,
hold on, something's going on here, something a little strange, a little uncanny or off. Yeah. And these moments in time, these blips that you're talking about, start to maybe ramify in a different way. We're thinking, hold on, is this a realist book, or is there something kind of magical realism happening here? Or is it kind of like the three-body problem? Is there sci-fi involved? And it does have quite a few resonances with the three-body problem as well, which we'll get to in a bit. But, yeah.
Yes.
So how did you feel about the character of Nick? Did you like
him? I loved him.
I loved him too.
And he has this wonderful friend called Timothy. They live on this little island in the middle of the Puget Sound, which is pretty remote in Seattle. And Nick and his mother, Lily, are so poor that he gets a job getting up in the morning to go and collect oysters.
I learn a lot about oyster shucking and oysters.
Oh, we learn a lot about food actually in this. It turns out that Rachel Kong is actually a former food magazine executive.
Lucky Peach. Do you remember that?
Lucky Peach.
Yes. I knew that name was familiar. Yeah.
And she also, funnily enough, wrote a book about how to cook eggs. Or edited it. And there's so many eggs in this book. Very funny. But food actually becomes a way of talking about a lot of things, not just caring and family and giving and helping the health of your loved ones, but it's also about culture and what you don't eat and prestige. So Matthew's family are always drinking and eating the finest things of the world with their private chefs and in the world's best restaurants. So food's a real strength of Rachel Kong's writing.
It's a cultural marker, but it's also a class marker, because as this book unfolds more and more, we realize it's about race. It certainly is. For me, it's very much a book about class and money, and how much can money delineate what we can achieve in our lives. Mm-hmm. And if we can somehow attach ourselves to money, if there's proximity to money, then does that mean we have the power that money entails? Not necessarily is the answer, I feel, but it's open for interpretation in the book.
And it's also about ethnic identity, and we see Lily's challenge, not looking Chinese but not being Chinese, seeing herself as a real American, which is the title. And then her son Matthew being this blonde, blue-eyed Adonis type who I really strongly identify as half Chinese.
Yeah.
People just laugh at him.
Yeah, exactly.
So when he's finished school and actually moves out of home, he goes and learns Mandarin and is very proficient at it. It becomes part of his job. And he meets a woman who is African-American and Chinese, and they seem to have this resonance in
there. There's a co-understanding there, but it's also, at first she says, like, are you, like, you seem white to me? And he's like quite offended, because he's like, no, like, I get it. I am Chinese. I understand what it's like to not be assumed to be the general person in society. But then it's also a college romance in the sense that, you know, they both treat each other terribly and kind of are kids falling in love.
Yeah, and there's an echo of the other relationship between Matthew's parents. So then we go into the third and final section, and I thought this was beautifully written, and it did a good job of explaining the silences within the generations, I think. Mm. We're taken back to China where Lily's mother, who's been a presence in the novel, grew up as a very poor young girl in the Mao era, having to kill sparrows as part of the Great Leap Forward, but eventually won a place at Beijing University.
Yeah.
And she becomes, dun, dun, dun.
She becomes a scientist. She becomes an incredible geneticist who is really interested in the ways that we can change genetics to maybe alter the future of humanity, or at least individual humans. She starts originally looking at the lotus flower, which is another symbol throughout the novel, but then turns to genetics in humans and meets some interesting funders along the way.
She meets a very, very large pharmaceutical company, which is based in America, which may or may not have the same name as Matthew's true surname.
So essentially all of these strings, all of these threads that we don't want to kind of go into too much to ruin this story, they all come together to kind of form what is essentially a book about what is a real American and how much can the individual ever make their own luck in relation to, in this sense, it's big pharma, but really, you know, big America is the idea, big corporations. How do those two things work in tandem or not with each other?
And who gets to be happy? And in some ways it is the rich, but in others it really isn't.
Yeah, yeah. And people are trying to constantly either stick to their morals and then be thwarted at every stop because money makes the world go round, or they're really embracing their kind of maniacal billionaire status. But each of the characters, I think, has some redeeming qualities. We do have empathy for some of the people that we might want to hate the most, which is really well done.
Yeah.
It is a page turner in the sense that we think that it's one thing, maybe a generational saga about intergenerational trauma, Chinese American identity, but then it's also a rom-com, and then it's also kind of this sci-fi scenario in some ways.
And it's Chinese history. And big pharma.
Yeah. And so it kind of, in the kind of saga-ness of it and the constant companion of the corporation and medicine, it actually did remind me of Lessons in Chemistry.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is not something that would maybe be paired with it like that quickly, but it just had that vibe, for lack of a better academic term.
Sort of popular science unfolded or laid bare,
yeah,
I suppose.
And looking at how kind of people who are not the men that usually we see in kind of science history have contributed hugely to the development of science, the women, the non-white people who have been subjugated along the way but kept going.
One of the things I loved about this book was the way nature was this constant silent backdrop in each of the scenes, and whether it was the perfect orchid growing in Matthew's apartment or the four-leaf clovers that Lily's mother was somehow able to find everywhere, probably genetically manipulated, I thought. Or the trees, the way the trees were turning in a season, or the way oysters grew. So nature was a very big presence, but not announced loudly. And I liked that.
Rachel Kong, Real Americans.
Wow, great reviews. Thank you both, Madeline and Ben. Let's get some recommendations from you. What about you, Benjamin Law? What have you read lately that you'd like to recommend?
I would love to recommend two books. One is a book that came out, I think, towards the end of last year. Australian writer, but also an Australian illustrator. Her name is Sarah Firth. Her book came out through Joan, which is Nakia Louie's imprint, through Allen and Unwin. And it's a book called Eventually Everything Connects. And I've been a huge fan of Sarah's artwork on Instagram for a really long time and her comic strips. But these are like really meaty, delicious, delightful, poignant essays about being alive and relationships and sexuality and shame. And so it reminded me of, I don't know, really good essays by Garner and Didion and people who really interrogate their interior world. But it also reminded me of really great graphic novelists out there like Roz Chast and Myra Kalman as well. And I think it's going to be the book that I just keep giving to people throughout the year. You know, sometimes you find that book and you think, I don't know how anyone couldn't love this book.
Yeah.
That's the book. It's called Eventually Everything Connects. The second book, I'm going to do something a little bit cheeky. I'm going to recommend a book that isn't even out yet. It's so obnoxious, isn't it?
I'm going to do it too. This is so annoying.
Oh, my God.
Maybe it's the same one.
Really? On the count of three, do you want to try?
The title or the author?
One, two, three.
A Language of Limbs. Yeah. Okay, it's different. That was fun. Didn't you feel tense, everyone?
Paper rock.
So my one is called A Language of Limbs. It's written by a local writer called Dylan Hardcastle. They're trans non-binary author who writes deliciously about queer relationships. And this one, again, sort of like Xiang Lu, when we were talking before, is a dual narrative. It follows two women through the 70s and 80s. And of course, when we're going through those kinds of narratives, we're going to be encountering the HIV/AIDS crisis in Australia.
I thought you were going to say lots of bad haircuts.
Oh, and
Madonna.
That too.
That too, they go hand in hand.
The decade contained multitudes. And you're following these two women's lives and you see how sometimes they intersect and they brush past each other, but you know they're going to collide, and there's beautiful question mark throughout the entire book as to how that's going to happen. But alongside that, it's a gorgeous and really revealing history lesson that's told through joy and pain. And one of the things I really love about the book is you pick it up expecting, okay, we're going to do that story. Mm. There's going to be pain, and there is. But it's really a book about queer joy as well. And I really, really love the way that Dylan's crafted this with such care and love. And it's very cinematic. It's very episodic. You read a chapter and it's like, why don't I do another? And by the time you finish the end, it's like, wow, I've just inhaled that entire thing. So that's coming out in June, I'm pretty sure, the end of June. It's called A Language of Limbs by Dylan Hardcastle.
You can binge a book.
Mm-hmm. You can. You're allowed. It's legal.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. Well, Madeline.
Well, I've already given spoilers.
You've got your pen out writing these names down.
I am.
We actually do list all the books discussed on the program page. So if you're listening and you're running around like Madeline looking for a pen, never fear. It'll be all there. So.
So the book that I want to first recommend is Jessie Tu's second novel, The Honey Eater. Obviously, her first novel, A Lonely Girl is a Dangerous Thing, popped off and was, you know, the OG sad girl novel in Australian culture, I feel, at least in, you know, in the past 20 years at least.
Jessie's a reviewer for us quite regularly, so I think that's how we might introduce her next time.
The OG sad girl.
Basically, The Honey Eater is a really different kettle of fish. It was actually strong resonances with the books we're talking about today, in the sense that it's about an Asian Australian woman who is an academic translator. It starts with her and her mother going on holidays to France and kind of trying to connect to each other despite having very different life experiences. And in that way, it really reminded me of Jessica Au's Cold Enough for Snow. But then it comes back to...
Which one, Ben? The Prime Minister's Literary Award.
Yeah. It's a big deal.
Which you presided over.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book.
Yeah. Stunning book.
So it kind of has that element, and then it kind of returns to Australia and becomes more of a thriller in terms of the ethics of translation and stolen words and who, you know, who has the right to tell which story. And it becomes something else entirely. So Jessie's just done a wonderful job. I read it in a day and I can't wait for it to come out. So that comes out in July. And then, Ben, I feel like we're kind of doing some mind meld here.
Yeah,
because
we're do-si-do-ing in a literary way.
Yeah, because the other book that I wanted to recommend is also from the Joan imprint.
Oh, that's so funny. What is it?
Which is, I know it's gotten a lot of praise, but it should just get more, which is Dress Rehearsals by Madison Godfrey.
It's such a great collection, isn't
it? It's so beautiful. Do you know it, Cassie?
I have it on my desk, but have not been able to consume it.
It's essentially like kind of a memoir in prose poetry. Madison is non-binary, and it's about kind of existing on the periphery of gender, which sounds very serious, but Madison is serious and also so silly.
So funny.
So funny.
Funny poetry, everyone.
It's so funny. Ooh, and in that way, it kind of reminds me of like Hera Lindsay Bird in that kind of absurdist sense, but then it has something I think truly Australian and almost kind of larrikin, which is a dirty word kind of, but she's queered the larrikin, maybe.
Yeah.
And I recommend that to everyone.
So. I like that collection a lot too.
And we have had Madison Godfrey on the program as a guest. So there you go. And the book is called Dress Rehearsals.
It seems only minutes that we've been together, but sadly it is time. It is time to say farewell to Benjamin Law and Madeline Gray.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much for having us. A delight.
Oh, Madeline Gray and Benjamin Law, what fine guests, Cassie, and, well, another fine guest, that's me. I won't be back for another couple of weeks, but I'll be back again.
You will be missed.
Like a bad penny.
You're not a bad penny, Jonathan Green. It's been lovely talking with you, and I look forward to speaking again in a couple of weeks. Well, next time on The Bookshelf, Tom Wright will be here, and we're reading Claire Massoud's This Strange Eventful History, The Coast Road by Alan Murren, another Irishman, and Enlightenment by Sarah Perry.
But I also want to let you know about a event that's coming up if you're in Sydney. The fantasy writer Samantha Shannon will be in conversation with the book show's Claire Nichols, talking fantasy, fandom, female desire, all kinds of things. Shannon is the best-selling author of the dystopian series The Bone Season and her fantasy novels The Priory of the Orange Tree, along with its prequel A Day of Fallen Night, and she is huge. Anyway, you can see Samantha Shannon in conversation with Claire Nichols on Sunday, the 26th of May at 1 p.m. at the Riverside Theatre in Parramatta in Sydney. Just head to the Riverside Theatre website to book tickets and search for Samantha Shannon. I'm Cassie McCullough. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.